It's good to see each of you here today, and it's good to be with you. Loneliness, fear, hate, love, frustration, death. Six reasons why people cry. I'll give you a seventh. It was Thursday night a couple of weeks ago. We were at High Points Estates. It was the afternoon. Corey was doing what they call a first look, which means we get to see her in her dress prior to the ceremony. I'm in the chapel. I'm facing Windus so that my back is to where she'll come in. I've talked myself into being tough and being ready. And when I turned, I cried. A seventh reason, joy. There are three occasions in the New Testament where the Bible states that Jesus cried. Each has its own significance, but when we look at them collectively, they show Jesus, as prophesied, he was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. This morning I want us to consider those three events where Jesus cried and some lessons connected to each. To begin with, Jesus cried at the grave of Lazarus. Those were tears of sympathy. I'm in John chapter 11, if you want to turn your Bible. We'll begin our reading in verse 29. John 11 and verse 29. You will remember from the account that Lazarus now has been dead for 4 days. The sisters, Mary and Martha, both made an effort collectively to get Jesus to come while their brother was still alive but sick. But that has been put off for the purpose of what he does later in this chapter. As he's coming, Martha goes out and greets him because she hears that he is coming, and they have an exchange, which is interesting, 24, 25, 26, and 27. Then she goes and gets Mary, her sister. And Mary, when he heard that Jesus was coming, arose quickly in verse 29 and went into him. Now Jesus was not yet come unto the village, but was still in the place where Martha met him. The Jews then who were with her in the house and were consoling her, when they saw Mary, that she rose up quickly and went out, followed her, supposing that she was going unto the tomb to weep there. Mary therefore, when she came where Jesus was and saw him, fell down at his feet, saying unto him, Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews also weeping who came with her, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled, and said, Where have you laid him? And they said unto him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. I submit to you that the tears of Jesus on this occasion demonstrated his humanity. If we would read the Gospel of John, and then I would ask you, give me a theme that you came up with based upon your reading of that book. You would be right when you would say, the theme of this book is the deity of Christ. Absolutely. But John was not only blessed to write about the deity of Christ, he was also blessed to write about the humanity of Jesus. Remember, from a deity standpoint, he began, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. On the humanity side, in verse 14, he wrote, And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. You know, some people misunderstand this behavior, this act of crying, as it relates to Jesus. They say, if he was God, why would he cry? You see, they misunderstand, or more likely, they're not taught regarding the truth that Jesus was also fully man. The word flesh has various meanings in the New Testament, but in the context of John chapter 1 and verse 14, The word flesh has reference to human nature. John, by inspiration, declares that the divine nature of Christ and the human nature of Christ became fully united. If you want just one example, we could multiply many times. If you want to look at the humanity of Christ and the deity of Christ in balance, we can do that even in this chapter. We read the first verse, verse 35. From a human standpoint, Jesus wept. Well, from a deity standpoint, look at verse 43. And when he, Jesus, had thus spoken, he cried with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." He that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. You know, being fully human, Jesus was subject to quote-unquote life things, just like we are. He got tired. He got hungry. He got thirsty. Even emotional. Sometimes to the point of tears. The tears of Jesus at the grave of Lazarus demonstrate also something else for us important to see, and that is that Jesus had a very sympathizing and compassionate heart. On this occasion, Jesus cried because he loved Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. You can read that from verse 5 of the same chapter. His love for Lazarus was even obvious to the crowd, because in verse 36 it says, "Then the Jews said, see how he loved him." Have you ever thought about how our Lord feels when we cry? From his heavenly viewpoint, he sees tears of loneliness. He sees tears of fear. He sees tears of frustration. He sees our tears when someone we love leaves the Lord, then repents and returns. He sees our tears when someone we love suffers physically and mentally due to disease or old age. He sees our tears when we might suffer physically or mentally due to disease and old age. He sees our tears when someone we love passes from this life. Please understand that in all those situations and more, the Lord has the same divine sympathy and compassion for us as he did for Mary and Martha. What he felt for them, he feels for us. And so does God the Father, and so does God the Spirit. There's one simple lesson for us here. As a song we sometimes sing, we need to be more like the Master when it comes to having a compassionate heart and sympathizing with the needs of others. Which means sometimes we need to weep with those who weep. Someone wrote, "Tears are words the heart can't express." Secondly, Jesus cried regarding Jerusalem. These were tears of sorrow regarding others. Turn, if you would, to Luke chapter 19. Luke, the 19th chapter. We'll begin our reading in verse 41, but let's set it up in regards to the context. If you go back to verse 29, the setting now is Sunday. This is Sunday before Thursday, the Thursday in which he will institute the Lord's Supper in the upper room. This is Sunday before the Thursday he will go out to the Garden of Gethsemane and eventually be arrested. This is Sunday before the Friday morning that he will be crucified. This is the Sunday 1 week prior to his
resurrection.
He's coming towards the city of Jerusalem. He sends two of his disciples into the village, Bethany, and a colt is retrieved for him. Garments are placed along on the colt, and then you have garments that are thrown in the way along with branches. And people are shouting, "Blessed is the King that cometh in the name of the Lord," verse 38. And then verse 41, "And when he," Jesus, "drew nigh to Jerusalem, he saw the city and wept over it, saying, If thou hadst known in this day, even thou, the things which belong unto peace, but now they are hid from thine eyes. For the day shall come upon thee when thine enemies shall cast up a bank about thee and compass thee around and keep thee on every side and shall dash thee to the ground and thy children within thee, and they shall not leave in thee one stone upon another, because thou knewest not the time of thy visitation." On the back of a colt, the great historical city of Jerusalem lies before Jesus. His omniscient eye sees quite a contrast. On the one hand, a beautiful, vibrant, thriving city. On the other hand, a smoldering, decrepit, and hideous ruin in the making. Tens of thousands of the city's inhabitants doomed to death. And as all these thoughts flooded the mind of Jesus, he cried. Consider for a moment the state of the majority of the people who lived in Jerusalem at the time. Instead of repenting as commanded, their hearts were hardened to the teaching of Jesus and his disciples. Instead of being converted to the one true gospel, they were content to remain spiritually ignorant, to remain in spiritual darkness. Now, a few lessons for us. If the Lord were here today, what would his reaction be as he drew nigh to the greater Austin area? Would he weep over this area like he wept over Jerusalem? What are some things that the Lord would see from his vantage point? He would see that the majority of the people are in love with this world. Is it not obvious that the majority of the people that we know live for this world? John would be inspired to warn us, "Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world." Why, John? Because if a man loved the world, the love of the Father is not in him. 1 John 2 and verse 15. Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, would warn us regarding our attitude toward things. Remember the verses about laying up treasures? Matthew chapter 6, "Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth." Why? "Where moth and rust doth consume, and where thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth consume, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. For where thy treasure is, there will thy heart be also." When Paul wrote to the young preacher Timothy, he wrote words in 1 Timothy chapter 6, first about the contentment we're to have with the things that we have, but then there was a charge he gave in verse 17. "Charge them that are rich in this present world," and as Brother Mike prayed just a while ago, prior to us giving back, we are all rich here this morning. Financially, we are all rich here this morning. Charge them that are rich in this present world that they be not high-minded, nor have their hope set on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who giveth us richly all things to enjoy. From his vantage point, he would see the majority of those who consider themselves religious are really indifferent to him, to his teaching, and to his authority. Indifferent. The majority don't care who Jesus really is. The majority couldn't care less about what I hold in my hand and the authority of the words written in it. Is that not obvious from the standpoint of people think it's okay to worship God any way they like? And yet, the Bible teaches whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of, by the authority of. Who? Not just anybody. The name which is above every name, Jesus Christ. Giving thanks to God our Father through him. He would see cities filled with people who don't really know him. Think with me for a minute. Why was Jesus really crying regarding the inhabitants of the people who lived in Jerusalem? Why is he really crying? Because tens of thousands of them would lose their life in the most horrible way when the city was conquered? Yes. But is that it? Is that the extent of it? Is it just the loss of human lives that moved Jesus to tears? No. No, his deep sorrow was that the majority would be lost eternally. In truth, they did not know him. In truth, they did not love him. It's one thing to say, I love Jesus. It's another thing to really mean it. You remember in 1 John chapter 2 and verse 3, John wrote, and hereby we know that we know him. When what? When we keep his commandments. And we have already concluded that the majority of the people, besides not knowing what the commands are, don't care. Don't care. How can I state I love Jesus, I love God, when I don't know his commands and I don't obey them? The answer is, I can't. In the same book, 1 John chapter 5, this time I'm beginning our reading in verse 2. 1 John 5 and verse 2, hereby we know that we love the children of God. Brother Harold prayed in that regards to our blessing of being here this morning. Why? Based upon the fellowship we have with one another, being able to see our brothers and sisters in Christ, partaking of the Lord's Supper. And in the thoughts of partaking of the Lord's Supper, I'm thinking, I am surrounded by people who believe as I do. I'm so thankful for that. Love we have for each other. How do we know that we love the children of God? When we love God and do his commandments. He continues, for this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. And his commandments are not grievous. Notice, for whatsoever, whosoever is begotten of God overcometh the world. That's what I want. I want to overcome this world. And this is the victory that overcometh the world. What is it? The faith. The faith in what? And who is he that overcometh the world? Verse 5, but he that believeth that Jesus is the Son of God. Also, isn't it likely Jesus would see as he approached the greater Austin area, New Testament Christians who are lukewarm just like those New Testament Christians were in the church in Laodicea? We might call this even an indifference, sort of non-caring. I'm not turning my back on the Lord, but I'm sure not fervent. I'm sure not on fire for him. I'm just sort of taking the middle ground. And yet, to the church in Laodicea, the Lord would say, I know thy works, that thou art neither cold nor hot. I would that you were cold or hot, but because you are lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, I will spew thee out of my mouth. And finally, might he see New Testament Christians who have forgotten that this world is not our home, that we're just pilgrims and strangers. You know, the Hebrew writer, in referring to those in Hebrews chapter 11 that he'd already mentioned in the first part of the chapter, said, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them of afar, were assured of them and embraced them and confessed. This was a part of their conversation. When they talked to other people and shared the gospel with them, shared their faith, the faith with them, they confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on this earth. That's what people heard. That's what people saw. I have a quote in my Bible. I'm not sure who it originated with. We are not citizens of this world heading to heaven. We are citizens of heaven heading through this world. Does that describe us? And number three, Jesus cried at the prospect of his own death. These were tears of suffering. I'm looking at Luke chapter 22 and verse 39. The song that we sang before the Lord's Supper goes hand in hand with what we're reading here. This scene in the garden, when he came out and went, Luke 22 and verse 39, as his custom was, unto the Mount of Olives, and the disciples also followed him. And when he was at the place, he said unto them, pray that ye enter not into temptation. And he was parted from them about a stone's cast. And he kneeled down and prayed, saying, Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. And there appeared unto him an angel from heaven, strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became, as it were, great drops of blood falling down upon the ground. And when he rose up from his prayer, he came unto his disciples and found them sleeping for sorrow, and said unto them, why sleep ye? Rise and pray, that you enter not into temptation. If all we read would be the gospel accounts of Jesus and his suffering in the Garden of Gethsemane, we would miss out on something very important and insightful. The Hebrew writer adds another detail about this emotionally charged night, this painful night in the Lord's life. He adds the detail of the account of tears. In Hebrews chapter 5, verse 7, Jesus is who is speaking of here, who in the days of his flesh, having offered up prayers and supplications, now note, with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, and having been heard for his godly fear. Think about the mental anguish that was weighing on Jesus at this stage of his earthly ministry. He was about to be betrayed by one of his own, denied by another, and then forsaken by all. Tried all night, tortured just short of death, and then if that wasn't enough, he'd bear his cross by himself at least part of the way to a hill just outside Jerusalem's walls, where he, the sinless Son of God, would be crucified. I don't know about you, but I can't even begin to grasp the sum of those emotions. Can't. It begs the questions, how did he do it? Why did he do it? What motivated him to see it through? His love for the world, humanity. More personal, his love for you and me. His willingness to redeem fallen mankind so that the Father could extend grace, so that he could be the atoning sacrifice, the propitiation, bridging that gap, satisfying the wrath of God, so that we can even approach him in prayer and thank him and ask him for the things that we need. He did it for his love for the world, his willingness to redeem fallen mankind, and he did it, number three, because of his unfailing determination to do the will of the Father. Thus, a weeping Jesus learned obedience by the things which he suffered. And having been made perfect, he became unto all them that obey him the author of eternal salvation. Hebrews chapter 5, 8, and 9. Now listen carefully. Two things. Two things regarding the tears of Jesus. Number one, the tears of Jesus could not substitute for his own obedience. You see that? And number two, the tears of Jesus did not cause God the Father to change his purpose. Have you ever thought about that? What that would have been like for God the Father to see God the Son in tears in the garden regarding what faced him. And even then, no change in regard to the divine purpose of God. Jesus still had to die. Now there are two lessons for us to get. One, the tears of people, even those who may profess they know Jesus and stand before him in judgment, professing they know Jesus, weeping while they do, cannot substitute for obedience. He said, Robert, that is hard. Come on. Listen to the Lord. Not everyone who saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father, the commands, the way by which we show we know him, that we love him, those are the ones who are rewarded. That's what Jesus said, not me. Not a doctrine that the Church of Christ holds to. What the Bible teaches. Second, the tears of Jesus also show us that a life of obedience here, get this, is not always easy. Someone may say that is an understatement. There will be tears. This is what Jesus said in Luke chapter 13. Strive to enter in through the narrow gate. That word strive, there's another word. Agonize. Can you imagine? You see the connection between agony and tears? Yes. Let's conclude our lesson. Let's do it this way. Let's draw a contrast. Let's draw a contrast between what the Bible says about tears as it relates to the saved and the lost. Revelation chapter 21. Revelation 21, beginning in verse 1. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth are passed away, and the sea is no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. I realize it's a challenging book. There are challenging passages. But just by reading this and not listening to what commentators might have to say regarding this, seems like to me I've just got a contrast between the world in which I now live, the earth that I now stand on, and the world to come. Heaven, the holy city, the new Jerusalem. And I heard a great voice out of the throne saying, "Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men. He shall dwell with them. They shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God." Fellowship continued, perfected. "And he," God, "shall wipe away every tear from their eyes." No tears in heaven, no sorrow given. All will be glory in that land. "And death shall be no more, neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore. The first things are passed away." Someday, you and I will cry our last tears. Someday. That eternal, glorious body that God has prepared that will be like his, speaking of Jesus, 1 John chapter 3, the one that never grows old, that body won't have tear ducts. Because that body won't cry. How hard is that to fathom? Really, really hard in this life. Because depending on your emotional state and just what makes you you, you could be an easy crier. Someone who cries easy, who sheds lots of tears. You will only do that in this life. Not in the next. Matthew chapter 13. The contrast between the saved and the lost. The saved will never cry again. Not in heaven. No tears. No tears in heaven. In Matthew chapter 13, beginning in verse 49. "So shall it be in the end of the world, the angels shall come forth and sever the wicked from among the righteous, and shall cast them," the wicked, "into the furnace of fire. There shall be the weeping and gnashing of teeth." I read of nothing in my New Testament that tells me that those emotions, that those actions will ever cease. You and I, we cry sometimes in this life. The day that Corey walked out, somebody could have put a timer on it. I don't really know. Kathy probably has a better idea how long I cried. But you know what? Later that evening, in celebration, I wasn't crying anymore. It had ceased. Even when we weep or cry through the night, many times joy, relief comes in the morning. That will not be the case for the lost. Can you imagine? Hundreds of thousands of years, the realization that I've been someplace hundreds of thousands of years weeping and gnashing, and I look ahead and there's no end. And there's no reason for any of us here this morning to be there. Not being believers. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, you ought to render obedience to the gospel. By being baptized, you're baptized into Christ. You're a part of the saved. Sins are forgiven. Access to the grace of God. And as Christians, it really ought to be a comfort. It ought to be something that we are just looking so forward to. That there's going to come a day when we won't see each other cry anymore regarding the things of this life. Because we will have passed on to the life to come. We will be with the Father, Son, and Spirit, His holy angels and the faithful that have lived down through the ages. And after hundreds of thousands of years has passed in that life, we will be looking forward knowing that it's not going to end. That it just continues as we enjoy an eternal fellowship with God and our brethren. If we can help you in any way this morning, we ask you to come while we stand and sing.